Merrill v. Merrill Lynch. Mr. Ireland.
If it pleases the court, my name is John C. Ireland. I am attorney for Mary Carroll, the appellant. This case is an appeal on a narrow issue regarding the Illinois Eavesdropping Act, which the act prohibits the unconsented recordings of conversations in the state of Illinois. Further, the Illinois Eavesdropper Act prohibits the reuse, the replaying, and re-recording of that original unconsented recording. And those reuses, re-recordings are separate violations of the act and separate civil causes of action. Now, this is a fairly narrow appeal in many ways, because much in this case that is before you are undisputed facts. There is no dispute that there was a recording of Mary Carroll. There is no dispute that there was a recording by Pat Kelleher or James Kelleher. Further, there is no dispute regarding the replay and re-replay of that unconsented recording and re-recordings of that recording. Finally, there is, to some degree, agreement that there was no consent. So the court is asked to decide, did the district court err when the court ruled that Pat Kelleher had proven her claim to an exemption from the act, and by that decision found that she had recorded Mary Carroll based upon a reasonable fear of crime. That is the exception that she claims in her affirmative defense, that her motivation was a reasonable fear of a crime to be committed by Mary Carroll. This is an error, in our opinion, Your Honors, because the district court ignored plenary evidence to the contrary. The plenary evidence, of course, would have to be used to prove the affirmative defense by Pat Kelleher, because, of course, it's an affirmative defense. It's her burden. She must prove it. And there is plenty of evidence to indicate the opposite, most of which is the defendant's own words. 2 months after the recording was made, Pat Kelleher, the person who made the recording, said to the police in a police report, "All I know about Mary Carroll is she got my husband's boss fired. She got my husband's boss fired. That's an economic motive. She feared the loss of his job, and that was what was causing it." It wasn't Pat Kelleher say to the police, "I thought she was going to throw a brick through the window." It was about the job. James Kelleher, the husband, when he got around to going to the police 3 days or 2 days or a day after the recording was made, said virtually the same thing. He made a report as a pro forma action. He said, "The employer is going to take care of it. Don't worry about it. I just want this for the record." Further, the defendant's own words also continued into the litigation. When I deposed her and asked her, what was the crime? What was she going to do, Mary Carroll, when you recorded her voice? What was motivating you? Her answer was, she kept threatening to take it to HR, take it to Human Resources at Merrill Lynch, in other words, to get my husband fired. And she said this in that deposition several times. Now, of course, she, of course, did say in one paragraph or one sentence, "Oh, yeah, I feared she was going to throw a brick through the window." But that is one statement in isolation with all the other evidence that contradicts that.
Is it your view, Mr. Ireland, that those are mutually exclusive motivations?
No, Your Honor. They're not mutually exclusive, But I believe it's a credibility determination to say that this one statement is proof of the affirmative defense.
We see, for example, often in employment discrimination cases, employers will identify several reasons for the action that they take. And that's perfectly okay.
That is correct, Your Honor. But if there's evidence that those reasons are untrue, then that is a credibility determination to say, well, this one is the right one. And that is what we believe the district court did, is chose which one was correct.
What is the evidence showing that the fear of crime was untrue?
The fact
that there were other motives?
No, that there was no other motive. We believe that there's no other motive indicated other than in this one paragraph. And that there's indications that it's not, the true motive isn't the fear of crime.
Because there were other motives.
No, Your Honor, because there's plenary evidence that it wasn't a fear of crime.
What you seem to be saying is that because there was more than one motive, we should disbelieve one of the two stated motives.
No, Your Honor, I'm saying that we should have a hearing to allow us to consider the credibility determination to see if Pat Kelleher is telling the truth on the stand. That it is a disputed question of fact. She claims in one sentence, yeah, I feared crime. But when pressed, she demonstrated that it was all about HR. And I would ask the court to allow me to present impeaching evidence, such as the police report, where she fails to mention this alleged brick through the window. Further, Your Honor, the evidence includes the very actions and inactions of Pat Kelleher and James Kelleher. This is further evidence of the true motive, which the district court did not consider, because instead of calling the police as soon as the phone call was recorded and getting the police to come to the house and prevent this alleged crime from happening, they instead called Merrill Lynch that night. They called Merrill Lynch, an economic motive. The next day, they didn't play it for the police in the morning. They played it for Merrill Lynch. Again, economic motive. That's the actions. And the inactions, of course, is the failure to contact the police anytime prior to Merrill Lynch saying, oh, by the way, you should go file a police report, at which time, when they went and filed a police report, they didn't even say, we fear for a crime being committed. They said, don't worry, Merrill Lynch is taken care of.
Mr. Ireland, there's something I'm missing here. Could you direct me to the statutory language that applies, in your view, to the re-recording and replaying for Merrill Lynch?
If I may have a moment, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not finding it, Your Honor. If I may present that on rebuttal.
Sure.
Thank you, Your Honor. Regarding all of this evidence, the district court described it as a hunch by the plaintiffs. I don't believe that the defendant's own words and the defendant's own statements and the defendant's own actions and inactions is a hunch. Rather, it is evidence which should be considered and, frankly, considered in a motion for summary judgment in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. That is what we have here. This is a motion for summary judgment in which the judge considered all of that evidence as a hunch. And I don't believe a defendant's words should be considered a hunch if I'm quoting them. Even if you consider the fact or assume the fact.
You aren't going to have any rebuttal if you keep up the good work.
I will stop this time, Your Honors. Thank you very much, and I will reserve my time.
Thank you, Mr. Ireland. Ms. Carroll. Excuse me, Ms. Miller.
Good May it please the Court. We agree that the sole issue before this Court is simply whether the District Court erred in awarding summary judgment with regard to the Illinois Eavesdropper Act claims by appellant. Judge Pallmeyer found there was no genuine issue of material fact because the undisputed facts, including appellant's own account of the incident, established that the recording fell within the reasonable suspicion of a crime exception. Judge Pallmeyer also found that there was no harm or damages that flowed from the recording. As this Court is aware, there is an exemption specific to recordings that are made under reasonable suspicion that another party to the conversation is committing or about to commit or has committed a criminal offense. The issue is the recorder's state of mind. To fall within the exemption, recorders have to show that at the time they pushed the record button, they had a suspicion that a crime was being committed or was about to be committed, and secondly, that the suspicion was objectively reasonable. Mrs. Kelleher testified. She didn't just say, as an aside, in there, I was afraid of a brick. What she said when asked directly why she recorded it was that she was scared. You know, it was late on Thanksgiving night. It was past 9 o'clock at night. There's somebody on the other end yelling at my husband, using profanity, and I hear my husband saying, I don't know what you're talking about. Can you please explain? I hear him, you know, in a calm voice. I hear the escalation and the voice of the person calling. I had no clue who this person was. I got scared that somebody was very angry for some unknown reason that I could tell in part the part I listened to. I felt that, you know, this person was going to come to our house, throw a brick through the window, and that we're going to do something that night. And I got scared. And I wanted to involve the police. And if we had to go to the police, I could say, you know what, this person, I don't know who they are, but this is what's scaring me. It's undisputed that immediately after the call, she urged her husband to call the police. This further corroborates that she had a fear of harm to her family. Even the appellant, Mary Carroll, says that she believed Mrs. Kelleher recorded the call because she was, quote, terribly upset and worried. There's no genuine dispute here but that Mrs. Kelleher made the recording under the suspicion that appellant was about to commit a criminal offense. The district court said that, based on the unrebutted testimony of Patricia Kelleher, she had the fear and thereby the suspicion when she pushed record. There's basically three arguments raised by opposing counsel. First, throughout their brief, they talk about how the fear of the crime was unreasonable. Second, they argue a mixed motive. And third, they argue that even if the original recording fell within the exemption, that subsequent re-recordings did not. With regard to the first argument, the district court properly found that the suspicion was reasonable as a matter of law. The undisputed evidence supported that the Kelleher's fear was objectively reasonable. Appellant argues that this is always a question of fact. In McWilliams versus McWilliams, a 2007 decision by the Northern District, the court specifically found that threats and aggression voiced by the plaintiff made it reasonable as a matter of law. Here, there's undisputed facts showing that Patricia Kelleher's fear of a crime was reasonable as a matter of law. The call was at 9 o'clock, Thanksgiving evening. Appellant was yelling and using profanity. As the district court noted, plaintiff agreed that during the call, she acted inappropriately, was enraged, was irrational. Her testimony and what she told her coworkers the next day was that she effing snapped. That's what happened on that call. She was very angry. She admits she was dramatic and all riled up. There are no credibility determinations made or required by the court because both women's testimony was consistent that the call was alarming and threatening. It is also important to note that the state made the same determination. The state, who talked to Patricia Kelleher, the police talked to Patricia Kelleher, talked to Jim Kelleher, they determined they would not prosecute criminally under the Eavesdropper Act because it fell within this exemption. Clearly, that was part of the discussion that they had with Ms. Kelleher, was this concern about a crime.
Ms. Miller, could I ask you, as far as I can tell, the conversation that, to the extent it occurred, was between Mr. Kelleher and Ms. Carroll, how was Mrs. Kelleher a party to the conversation?
She was not a party to the conversation. She heard from a few feet away what was transpiring with her husband. She heard the voice and the escalation of the voice, and she said she went upstairs and on a family answering machine pushed record, picked up, listened for a few minutes, and pushed record.
Under the statute, doesn't she need to be a party, and should we treat folks who are part of the same household who listen on extensions as parties to conversations.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the statute for this exemption specifically talks about if the recording is made under reasonable suspicion of the conversation that another party to the conversation is committing or about to commit or has committed a criminal offense against the person or a member of his immediate household. So I think the judge properly found that that would be covered under the Act. The second argument by appellant was that the mixed motive somehow precluded summary judgment. The district court ruled, even assuming that the loss of the husband's job was among Patricia Kelleher's fear, that didn't mean she didn't also fear commission of a crime. As this court's already mentioned, the fact that there are two doesn't mean that one is inconsistent with the other, that there's often several reasons involved, several concerns. They're not mutually exclusive, as admitted by opposing counsel. The statute also doesn't say solely because or even because. It says suspicion, recording made under reasonable suspicion. Clearly, this was a motivation that was at play. With regard to subsequent replays and re-recordings, the district court properly held that if the original recording fell within this exemption and was protected, was a legitimate, lawful recording, then obviously any subsequent re-recordings would not be unlawful.
Would that apply, for example, to posting it on YouTube? You know, that is a use that is not related to the original purposes.
Your Honor, I believe that what you post on YouTube, it may implicate other privacy or other issues, but with regard to violating this specific act, it would not violate this act. The original conversation, which was recorded, was protected because of the circumstances and why it was recorded, so it's a legitimate recording.
So it could be used for news purposes or
I believe
distributed
it could be,
without
it could,
limitation?
Sure. I believe it could be used without limitation as far as violating this specific act. As far as other privacy and other issues, those could come into play. I'd also close by just mentioning another basis for the summary judgment ruling was that there was no harm, even if the act was violated. Here, as the district court noted, there's no evidence that she suffered. She claimed she was terminated as a result of the recording. The decision maker clearly testified, and the evidence supports that she would have been terminated even without the recording. There was a memorandum by Jim Kelleher of the conversation, which was sent to his managers the day after. Mary Carroll's testified that he properly, that was an accurate depiction or description of what happened. Obviously, so in summary, what Mary Carroll and her counsel is asking this court to do is to send this back to a judge and devote resources to hearing the same testimony, which was subject to cross-examination, which was heard and which she reviewed very closely, and for her to determine again whether the suspicion or reasonable suspicion of a crime occurred and whether it falls within that exemption. At that point, even if the judge were to make a different determination, then it's already been found there were no damages. So this would be an exercise in futility and a waste of judicial resources.
Anything further?
You're waiting for a question. None is coming.
Okay. Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. Mr. Ireland?
Thank you, Your Honors. In regards to your inquiry, I believe the statute reuse and rebroadcast is covered in Exhibit 7, page 9, and that is my motion for reconsideration, which discusses uses or divulging of the information is separate acts. It's paragraph 54. Of course, that's a partial citation, and of course, the act itself is a public act, and I could provide additional case or statutory support if you'd like, Your Honor.
Sorry, Exhibit 7 to what?
To my briefs.
I'm looking at the wrong appendix.
Okay. Sorry. Mr. Ireland, would you speak, if you would, to damages here?
Yes, Your Honors. The damages question was not briefed at the district court level in the summary judgment motion. What defense counsel is referring to was kind of an off-the-cuff request by the district court to me, not in a hearing, not in an evidentiary hearing, and frankly something that I had never been addressed to me. I would submit that there was damages, even if you take out the loss of the employment, which we of course believe is the primary loss. There is additional damages. There is cost of the action, attorney fees applicable under the act, and of course emotional distress and things that are not monetary. Of course, all of these, the recording of the voice has caused distress and inconvenience to the plaintiff. So there are damages, and secondarily, Your Honors, there was never an adequate briefing or hearing on the damages. Regarding one other point, and I see my time has expired, and I thank you.
You can conclude that thought.
The reasonable suspicion. Counsel mentioned reasonable suspicion. I don't believe the suspicion was reasonable if the fear of crime existed based upon Pat Kelleher's own testimony that she's a fearful person, she sought treatment for that fearfulness, and that she even testified in the deposition that Mary Carroll might leap over the plaintiff's table.
Do you think that's a fair characterization of the testimony here? Your question, you think Mary Carroll is going to jump across the table and hurt you? Answer, I don't know what she's capable of. You think that's her saying she's buying into your language? Do you think that's a fair characterization?
Perhaps I am reading into it, Your Honor.
And the treatment you're talking about was just talking with a clergy member from time to time, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And she rejected every effort of yours to put her in the deposition, to put her into some kind of psychiatric illness category, correct?
Well, Your Honor, I would
she talked to her preacher.
Yes, that's correct.
Do you have anything else?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks to both counsel.